37. The school had shut for the day. Brooke stood in front of her living room window, which usually had a view of the river, the town, and the mountains across the valley. She could barely see the clock tower of the school down below, and everything else was a powdery blur. The enormous mountain range blended into the white sky and had become completely invisible. It was the kind of weather that would cause even a hardy Coloradan to break out the booze and start searching Netflix. Going out was not looking very friendly, and it was about to get worse. The television was droning on behind her. A perky blonde meteorologist was delivering the local news, announcing the arrival of a statewide blizzard. "We haven't had a storm this big and this early in the fall for 22 years, and that one took 7 lives, stranded thousands, and caused widespread power outages across the state. Denver International has already canceled a number of flights," she announced. "And we're expecting slippery streets for your commute. Take your time, folks, and when you get home, stay in and stay warm." Sloane had not yet returned from school, despite the early dismissal, and Brooke was about ready to admit herself to a mental institution. Nick had gone over the railing the previous evening, and since then, Brooke had been one drink short of losing her mind. She and Asha had escorted Sloane out of the training room and down the stairs, and left the building without the girl ever being anywhere near the gym. At one point, on the way home, Sloane said, "Where did Coach Nick go?" To which Brooke had promptly answered, "The bathroom." That was it. That was the only question Sloane asked. She'd seemed sleepy but otherwise okay, and Brooke made the decision to wait and see what she might eventually remember. Brooke had thought about taking her straight to the ER, but whatever it was that Nick had slipped to Sloane, maybe one of those roofies she herself had been warned about in college, appeared to be wearing off. She needed to consider the consequences of showing up to a hospital, claiming that her daughter had been drugged by a man whom she'd just pushed over a balcony and left for dead. When Sloane sat up in the back seat and said, "Can we swing by Starbucks for a vanilla frappuccino?" Brooke said yes, and then took her daughter home. Brooke couldn't stop babbling afterwards. "What do you want for dinner, hon? Should we order salads? Should we order sushi? Can I make you avocado toast? Do you want to watch something? What about the two of us go soak in the hot tub for a little? I could braid your hair. I haven't done that in a long time." Sloane took her up on the avocado toast, but nothing else. Eventually, she remarked, "You're acting kind of bizarre tonight, Mom." "I am?" Brooke asked. "I mean, yes, I think I am. You're right. I think I had too much caffeine late in the day. That's got to be it." Brooke nodded emphatically while clutching her wine glass in both hands, because just one wasn't enough to keep it steady. At 10, Sloane had gone up to her room to do what she presumably always did in her room before bed, talked to Reed. As soon as Brooke saw Sloane's bare feet hit the top of the stairs and turn down the hall, she was out in the garage with a shot glass, standing in front of the freezer, holding the bottle of limoncello. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. She couldn't even manage to do a proper relaxation breathing exercise. She gave up on breathing and decided to go back into the house and pace. Pacing was therapeutic in a weird way. Once that had stopped working, she stripped naked and got into the hot tub, taking the limoncello with her. "I killed him," she whispered to the sky. She was drunk. "I killed him," she said again. Then she thought about what he'd done to Sloane and Mia. "And I'd kill the bastard again." In the morning, she woke face down on the living room couch. Sloane was nudging her.
"I'm off to school."
"Dad's here?" Brooke asked, half asleep.
"No, Mrs. Green, carpool." She paused. "Like usual?"
"Right, yeah." Brooke sat up and tried, unsuccessfully, to straighten her clothes and wipe the makeup and drool from her face. It was obvious that she'd passed out. Sloane didn't seem too bothered by any of it. "Have a good day, honey," Brooke said, standing up so quickly that she nearly fell right back down. After Sloane left, Brooke grabbed a pillow off the couch, held it against her mouth, and screamed. She tried to call Asha. No answer. She'd begun to receive texts and emails from the school informing parents about the shortened day due to an unforeseen tragic accident. Brooke had decided she was too hungover, panicked, and borderline psychotic to drive, so she texted Gabe to see if he could pick up Sloane and bring her home. He'd texted back, "No problem." That had been hours ago. Sloan was not responding to texts, not answering. Gabe, who was usually reliable, was also missing in action. This was absolutely the last thing Brooke needed. For the seventh time, she dialed Gabe.
Hello?
He sounded out of breath. It's about time, she yelled.
Whoa, what's wrong?
He asked, not apologetic, seemingly not concerned about anything. Is Sloan okay? Is she with you? Gabe sounded muffled, like he was in the middle of something.
She called me and said she was getting a ride home with a friend and not to worry. Sorry, hold on. I'm just walking in. Let me finish getting my hat and scarf off.
Gabe!
What?
Which friend?
Mia, he said.
Brooke could finally hear his voice clearly and pictured him with ice in his hair, about to shake it out like a wet dog. She missed him.
That's okay, right?
He asked. Brooke relaxed slightly. That was sort of okay. It was better than many other possibilities. Why didn't you call to tell me? And why haven't you been answering your phone?
I'm sorry, he said. I wasn't thinking. When the storm started coming in, Tabitha asked me to run some groceries over to her mom, and when I got back, I had to go out and salt the drive because ours is pretty steep.
These words, as innocuous as Gabe might have thought they were, almost brought Brooke to tears right then and there. He'd referred to the driveway of Tabitha's apartment as ours and taken food over to Tabitha's mom. It was a dagger in the heart. Brooke realized then that he had changed. He was invested, attentive. It appeared he could be a better, happier man with a woman who needed him and treated him like he was someone important.
Gabe, she said, I'm really sorry. No worries, he said. I should have had my phone on me.
No, Brooke said. I mean, I'm really, really sorry. I should have done better. I'm talking about us.
Oh, he said, drawing out the word. Brooke, it's okay. It's fine. I should have too. And just so you know, I am going to do better with Sloan. I'm going to make sure I have her every other weekend, if that's okay with you. Now that I'm settled and stuff.
Wonderful, Brooke said, even though she was devastated. He'd used the word settled.
That's great, Gabe. Thank you. Give me a call when she gets home, okay?
He asked.
I mean, she did say they were going to go hang out at a friend's for a little bit, but I would have thought she'd have been home by now.
Where were they going? Did she say?
No, she didn't. She just said,
I've got to run, Gabe, Brooke said, suddenly fully certain that if Sloan had left the school with Mia, it had been in the back of Reedley Lynn's G-Wagon. I'm sorry. Take care. Talk soon. 10 seconds later, Brooke sent the following text. Hi, Linda. Extending an olive branch here. Sloan's phone must be dead. Is she with Reed at your house by any chance? If so, could you please have her call me? Thank you. Linda texted back shortly thereafter. Hi, Brooke. I've asked her to give you a call. I know we agreed to limit Reed and Sloan's time together, but with the scary news from the school and the storm rolling in, I just thought I would make an exception. I'm sorry. I should have checked with you.
Oh, no, that's fine. I'd just like to have Sloan home with me. They're saying power outages.
Okay, but FYI, Reed has another friend over and the kids are having fun in the basement. Everyone is safe to ride out the storm. They are welcome to spend the night. We have plenty of room, generators, food, blankets, candles, you name it.
Sloan was in a basement in a snowstorm with her horny band boyfriend. And this mom thought everything was great and was talking about them curling up under some blankets by candlelight. Absolutely not.
That's so kind of you, Linda, but please tell Sloan I'll be coming to pick her up soon. Thank you.
38. The first thing Natalie did after leaving the school was drive way too fast through town. Her heart was racing, and she was consumed with thoughts of jail, escape, and her mom, who would be so ashamed when it all came out that Natalie had either killed someone or walked away from someone who was dying and needed help. Lost in thought, she missed a traffic light change from yellow to red and had to slam on her old grinding brakes. She skidded through the intersection, screaming in her own ears while two cars honked, passing her on either side.
As she tried to get back on the road, she felt her tires slipping. She had places to go and people to see, and it wasn't going to happen in her old Honda Civic tonight. 5 minutes later, she pulled up at Jay's.
"What the hell, Natalie?"
Jay shouted, swinging the front door open before she could even ring.
"Do you have any idea how worried I've been?"
"I'm sorry," she said. "I need your Jeep."
"What did you mean in your message, I did something bad? People are starting to spread rumors on Facebook and Snapchat. What happened at the school? Does this have something to do with the coach?"
"Yes, listen, it has to do with all that. But right now, I need your Jeep."
"What happened, Natalie?"
Jay planted his cane and leaned on it, scowling, as if waiting for a lengthy explanation.
"I don't know what happened, and that's the problem. I need to find out exactly what I did, so I can figure out what to do next."
Natalie ran around him, into the kitchen, and grabbed his keys from the Star Wars cup where he kept them, along with years worth of pennies. On her way back out, she said, "I'll explain everything later if I'm not in jail."
"What?"
he asked, trying to hobble after her frantically.
"Jail?
I've got to go. Thank you."
"Stop," Jay called after her. "Please stop. I'm really mad at you right now. I don't think you should be driving in this weather. No one should."
He sighed and rubbed his beard.
"Okay then, be careful. Make sure and use the four-wheel drive."
As Natalie sped away from Jay's house, she tried to imagine all of the awful things she might have done to Nick when she had blacked out. She could have crept through the door from the stairwell unnoticed, if his loud music was playing, to find him doing sit-ups in the corner. At the top of each crunch, the crown of his head would have been an easy target. Or perhaps he'd been using the rowing machine. Either way, he would have been vulnerable. She pictured herself, eyes black and empty, her whole body quivering with rage, standing above him with a round cast-iron weight in her hands. She could have cracked his skull like an egg. It was harder to imagine how she might have then managed to throw him over the balcony. Natalie knew where the Ellemans' house was located. People drove past it sometimes just to gawk at the size of the thing, perched up there above everyone else, now the lonely home of two beautiful, solitary females, like the premise of a gothic horror novel. Driving on her way to the other side of the river, she passed the parking lot at Price Chopper. It was still filled with cars belonging to last-minute storm stalkers, but the downtown and surrounding streets were mostly quiet. Jay's Jeep, with its raised chassis and oversized tires, gave Natalie confidence in the worsening blizzard, but the snow was blowing sideways in a frenzy. She tested the brakes, and the bright red warning sensor for icy conditions lit up on the dash. She was just one turn away from the street that would take her up to Brooke's house when she saw a car on the side of the road. It was a buttery-colored Mercedes with a personalized license plate that read, "Yum Cake." They were not old money, the Ellemans. Brooke was stunning and wealthy, but had never been subtle.
"Holy shit, that's her," Natalie said out loud, pulling over.
Brooke was in a silver parka, her long hair tangled and wet, hanging out from underneath a matching silver cap. She was pacing around and barking into her phone. Natalie rolled down the window and yelled,
"Mrs. Elliman, do you need some help?"
Brooke squinted through the snow in Natalie's direction.
"Miss Bellman?" "Yes, from the school. Are you stuck?"
Brooke nodded.
"They put me on hold." "Who did you call, AAA?"
"Highway Patrol," Brooke answered, stomping through a snowdrift to cross the road. She scrutinized Natalie, who was wearing a stocking cap with a pom-pom on top, and took a long look at Jay's souped-up Jeep with the fiery emblem of Adrenaline Extreme Sports splashed across the side.
"Get in and get warm," Natalie said, pulling the cap off.
Brooke barely hesitated. After she'd closed the passenger door, she took off her gloves and held her hands up to the hot air blowing out of the vents.
"Thank you," she said. "I shouldn't have been driving that car right now, I guess. My husband took the four-wheeler we usually use in the winter, and I haven't gotten around to buying myself one yet. I just wanted to go pick up Sloane and bring her home."
Sloane, just the person Natalie needed to see.
"Where is she? I'll take you to get her. This Jeep can handle pretty much anything."
"Would you do that?" Brooke asked, looking surprised and grateful.
"Really?"
"Of course. Where am I headed?"
"She's at Reed Leland's house, about 50 minutes from here, up Devil's Canyon for starters." Natalie began to drive. Brooke pulled down the mirror on the back of the sun visor and began to wipe damp spots of mascara from underneath her eyes.
I was just leaving my house to go get Sloane, and Linda Leland called me, having some sort of nervous breakdown, saying she had to see me right away to come this minute, crying, hysterical. The next thing you know, she had me so worked up, I turned my car right into that drift.
Well, that's upsetting. I'll have you there shortly.
Brooke shut the sun visor and sighed dramatically. I've had a traumatic 24 hours.
It was all Natalie could do not to respond. You don't say.
Brooke turned to look at Natalie. Thank you, Miss Spellman, for doing this.
It's not a problem. You can call me Natalie.
All right. In that case, why don't you call me Brooke?
Traversing the mountain towards the 6-acre ranch where the Lelands lived, Natalie tried to figure out the best way to start the conversation about what had happened to Nick.
It's really nice of you, especially, Brooke continued uneasily, because the last time we saw each other.
We don't have to talk about that, Natalie said, cutting her off. I just felt bad for Asha, and I said something to you that I shouldn't have said. How you conduct your private life, I mean, it's not my business.
Brooke blinked. Excuse me?
The last time I saw you, I said what I did because I know about you and Phil.
Me and Phil? Brooke asked indignantly. What on earth are you talking about?
Natalie briefly took her eyes off the swirling white mess ahead to glance at Brooke.
You two, you and Phil, seeing each other?
Natalie, Brooke said, I don't know where you got that idea, but it's absolutely not true.
His car was outside your apartment in the middle of the night a few weeks back.
Brooke considered this for a moment and then waved her hand dismissively.
Mia's been sneaking her dad's car out, Asha told me.
Well, what about the Le Meridien in Denver?
What about it? He stayed there, not me.
You never spent the night with Phil in Denver?
No, she paused. Actually, I did have dinner with him one night in Denver, that's true, but I only ran into him at Ocean Prime Seafood. He was there on business, and I was as well, and we ate some oysters and drank some wine. I never told Asha about it because he was in town dealing with some business trouble that he wanted to try to sort out without worrying her. I probably should have said something. I mean, now that I know you both suspected I was sleeping with him, I definitely should have said something.
I guess I just assumed.
Look, nothing ever happened between me and Phil Wilson. I know my behavior with men over the years has been inappropriate at times. I'm going to own that and change that. If I could go back in time and do things differently, I would. I lost my husband over it, and nearly my daughter, too. It breaks my heart to see how hurt Sloane is over the whole thing.
Natalie turned up the heat and made the windshield wipers go faster. She tested the brakes. The visibility was terrible.
I acted out way worse than Sloane when my dad left. I was a nightmare for my mom.
I'm sorry, Brooke said. I had no idea. What kind of trouble did you get in?
Natalie hesitated, then said, After he left, my mom got a prescription for Valium, and I tried it, and I liked it. My brother was older, and he let me come to parties with him and drink sometimes. One night I blacked out and woke up in a boy's bedroom. There were race car and heavy metal posters all over the walls, but I didn't know whose house it was. I couldn't remember much, just the words, it's okay, being whispered in my ear. I wasn't wearing all of my clothes. I knew something had happened, but I didn't know what, and I still don't know.
How did you deal with that? Brooke asked quietly.
I stole a long sweatshirt and walked home barefoot at 5 a.m. It was several miles. After that, I stopped drinking. For a long time, at least. I got a tattoo on my wrist.
Natalie left out the fact that the tattoo covered over a scar, the aftermath of a really bad night when she'd been trying to decide if she wanted to live or not.
It says self-love because I wanted to try to treat myself better. I think it's safe to say at this point that it wasn't a magic tattoo, not the talisman I'd had in mind. It didn't protect me after all.
What did your brother do when he found out?
He doesn't know, Natalie answered. I never told him. I was afraid he would kill the guy, or guys.
So you never said anything to anyone?
Until just now.
God, that's terrible.
Brooke was staring at Natalie, looking deeply troubled.
I can relate.
Sloane's had some very bad experiences, too.
You're right about that, Natalie said.
Brooke shifted in her seat uncomfortably.
What are you talking about?
I'm talking about Nick.
Brooke began to play with the door lock.
Which way do I turn? Natalie asked, slowing down for a stop sign.
Right,
Brooke answered, distracted.
What about Sloane and Nick?
How much do you know about what happened at the school yesterday afternoon? About what happened in the gym?
Very little, Brooke said. What do you know?
Quite a bit, actually,
Natalie answered, and Brooke grabbed the door handrest, squeezed, and waited.
I know the following things, Natalie went on, increasing the windshield wipers to a frenetic speed,
uselessly trying to help with the fog created by the snow.
I know that Nick is one of the people who was injured. I know that the police are investigating it as a crime.
Natalie rolled up to a stop sign and braked carefully. She turned to look at Brooke.
I know they think I attacked him, but I don't remember doing that. I also know that he did something terrible to your daughter.
What exactly?
He took photos of her, knocked her out somehow. The police know who was there. You, your daughter, a handful of others. But it probably comes down to two people. Either I hurt Nick, or Sloane hurt Nick, because of what he did to her.
Sloane didn't do anything wrong, Brooke said.
Are you sure?
Yes.
Left here?
Natalie asked, reaching a tea stop. She glanced at Brooke, who didn't answer.
Left here, Brooke?
Sorry, yes.
They passed several multi-acre ranches and drove through a quarter mile of forest. Brooke was quiet throughout, having placed one hand over her eyes. Her head was resting against the passenger window. They'd reached a giant wooden gate reading, Land O' Leland. Natalie started up the snowy asphalt drive.
Well, Natalie said, I guess that's it. I did it. It's not like it's the first time I ever blacked out and did something I regretted.
There was a heavy silence as Natalie parked the Jeep in front of the Leland Ranch. The house was huge, but strangely neglected. A soggy American flag was being pummeled by the snow and wind. It was situated next to a basketball hoop that was missing its net. A white plastic bag was stuck in the bare branches of a tree, and two green beer bottles had been tossed on top of the snow in the front yard. Finally, Brooke looked at Natalie and said,
It wasn't Sloane, and it wasn't you. It was me. It was me and Asha.
Oh my God, Natalie said. Are you playing with me?
Brooke said,
No, we knew what he was doing too.
Then you need to figure out your plan.
We don't have a plan. We're just saying we never saw him.
I'm sorry, Natalie said. I left out the one other thing I know.
What's that?
He's not dead. They're expecting him to wake up and tell them exactly what happened in the morning.
Before Brooke could try to speak, there was a knock against the window. It was Linda Leland in a house robe worn over a flimsy tank top, yoga pants, and knee-high rubber boots.
Linda,
Brooke choked out, rolling down the window.
I've been waiting for you,
she said, electrified and appearing borderline manic.
I wasn't sure if you'd make it or not,
she said, combing one hand through her disheveled hair.
I wouldn't have it if it weren't for Miss Bellman.
Miss Bellman?
Hi, Natalie attempted to smile at Linda, but it looked more like a sick grimace.
My house is a mess,
Linda blurted out, apropos of nothing.
I'd ask you in, but-
We just came for Sloane, Brooke answered. We don't need to come in.
No, Brooke, you do,
Linda said imploringly.
I told you on the phone. I have to talk to you. I don't know what to do. Please, Brooke, just you, just for a minute.
I'll wait in the Jeep, Natalie interjected quickly. I don't mind. I don't want to intrude.
Thank you for understanding, Linda said. I'm just not that comfortable with someone from-
I get it, Natalie answered, holding up a hand. I'll be here in the car. No worries.
Come in, Brooke, Linda said, opening the car door. Hurry, before I freeze.
Reluctantly, Brooke followed Linda into the house. Natalie had a very bad feeling in her stomach. She thought maybe she was going to throw up. Brooke and Linda had been inside the ranch house for all of 5 minutes when Natalie opened the Jeep door and leaned out. She took several deep breaths of icy air and felt better. A gunshot rang out in the night, and then another,
Natalie fell out of the Jeep into the snow, picked herself up, and went sprinting across the front yard towards the house as fast as her legs could move. Linda hadn't been joking. Her house was a mess, strewn with clothing, dirty plates, empty glasses, and dusty balls of hair and fluff under chairs and the tables. As soon as the door was closed, Linda pulled on Brooke's arm, dragging her into the living room. She pointed to the couch.
Sit, I have to tell you something. It's bad. It's very bad.
I'm listening. Linda began cracking her knuckles. The sound was sickening.
I owe you an apology. Actually, a couple.
Okay.
It was me that sent that email with the photo of Sloane. It was an old photo from before the scandal. Just a pretty picture on Reed's phone that I found, and she was dressed, wasn't she?
Barely, Brooke answered stonily, picturing the sports bra that had been hiked up to reveal the lower portion of Sloane's breasts.
Nick helped me.
What?
When you emailed me that article about the teenage boy going to jail for sharing photos of his girlfriend, I literally thought you were going to ruin Reed's life. It was a very scary threat. I didn't know who to reach out to, so I called Coach Nick for help, because he's been invested in Reed's future for 2 years, and I didn't think he would want to see my son go to detention. He told me what to do. He told me how to do it. He knew how to make the email look like it had come from somewhere else, another country, and also how to scare you without any real repercussions. We just needed you to stop causing problems. Neither one of us wanted to bring the police into the situation. You can understand that, right?
Brooke stared at Linda. She knew exactly why Nick had not wanted the police involved. He could have cared less about Reed's future. He was worried about himself. Nick would have been found out for the liar, abuser, manipulator, and predator that he was, so he had to make sure that no one made any waves whatsoever.
I shouldn't have done it, Linda went on. I was wrong. I was so, so wrong about Nick and about everything. I'm afraid to even tell you.
What?
Do you remember last spring when I said to you, it was all Sloane's idea to take those pictures? Do you remember?
Yes, of course I do.
I'm so sorry. It wasn't Sloane's idea.
So it was Reed's after all, like I said. Brooke was starting to lose enthusiasm for this outdated conversation. At this point, she had bigger worries than Reed.
No, kind of. It's more than that. Oh.
Linda trailed off like the story was just too big and complicated. Calm down, Linda, and tell me what happened.
Okay,
she began hesitantly.
Today, when the school let out early, Reed brought some friends back here. Later in the afternoon, after you and I texted, I called Reed upstairs. I was going to ask him to pass the message on to Sloane that you were coming to get her.
Brooke nodded.
And when he came up to the kitchen, I could tell he'd been crying.
Linda touched the corner of her eye.
I asked him what's wrong, and he said, Craig just called. Craig is his cousin. My nephew. He's a paramedic. And I said, okay, what's going on? And Reed told me that Craig said it was Coach Nick in the accident at the school, and that he was over at Colorado Medical dying.
Brooke swallowed and refrained from commenting. She opted for looking appropriately devastated.
Wow. And I said, oh, Reed, sugar, I'm so sorry. Because maybe I'm the dumbest mom in the world, but I truly believed those two were close after spending so much time together doing the private training sessions over the years. I said, you must be so sad.
Linda paused and reached for a tissue from a package lying on the coffee table.
And do you know what he answered?
Linda whispered, as if there were people listening.
He said, Mom, I'm crying because I'm happy. I hated him.
Linda sat back and blew her nose. You're kidding.
I was shocked, Linda answered. And I just hugged him because I knew there must be some absolutely awful reason he would say that. He's not a mean boy. He has some problems with alcohol, and he's obsessed with your daughter. But he's not a bad boy, you know? He's just a teenage boy. But why would he be glad Coach Nick was going to die? So I asked him while I was hugging him. I asked him why he felt that way. And he just kept hugging me, which he never does anymore, you know? He always pulls away. but he just kept hugging me so I couldn't see his eyes. But from his voice, I knew he was telling the truth. He said, it was Coach Nick that told me Jill's death was my fault because the only reason she ever drank was because I drank. Reed was so sad after Jill died, but then Nick swooped in to be his mentor and do the privates and help him heal. They got close, I guess. Nick tried to be his friend. For a while, I think it worked. Reed thought Nick was awesome, but then Nick told Reed that if Sloane loved him, she would take those photos for him. He egged him on about it for weeks. And then, when Sloane finally agreed to send him some photos, the first thing that happened was that Reed got busted with them by Coach Carmen, who stole his phone and reported the whole thing.
That's what Sloane told me, too, Brooke said. That Coach Carmen confiscated the photos, and that Nick was trying to keep it quiet and help the kids stay out of trouble.
Which is a lie, I now know. Nick never tried to keep those kids out of trouble. He just wanted them to be in trouble only with him, so he could control them. Reed says he wanted to see the photos of Sloane and was furious when he found out that Coach Carmen had gotten rid of them. He told Reed that he could still go to the police and tell them about the photos and that he had the final say on where Reed was accepted to college. And then, Linda threw her hands up in the air. And then, this sociopathic, sadistic piece of shit, trusted faculty member, started blackmailing my son. He wanted Reed to tell him everything they did with the girls. Parties and sex, drugs, you name it. All the info. He asked Reed to bring him drugs, club drugs, speed, prescription stuff, everything under the sun, at his condo in town. Blackmailing a student. Can you believe that?
Brooke very well remembered a night not long before when Sloane had snuck out with Reed, and the two had made a brief middle-of-the-night stop at an apartment in town, probably Nick's place.
Yes, I can believe it.
A tremendous gust of wind rattled the house, and both women looked towards the windows facing the backyard, as if expecting the glass to break. The howling of the storm was deafening.
Reed hated what was happening, Linda continued. He kept crying, Brooke. My big boy, my big teenage son who towers over me now, was holding me and crying. I can't believe it. I gave that horrible man $600 yesterday at the gym for Reed's private training sessions. I was paying the man who was hurting my son. I was so blind.
We all were, Brooke put her arm around Linda. It wasn't just you.
I know it's horrible to admit this, but just between you and me, I'm so glad he's gone.
Well, Brooke said, in that case, I've got some bad news. Before she could say anything more, there were three loud cracking noises outside. Brooke tensed up and said,
oh my God, now what?
Linda waved a dismissive hand.
Probably tree branches breaking from the wind.
She fixed Brooke with a stare.
What's the bad news?
The gunshots had come from the rear of the ranch house. Natalie trudged through the snow around the side of the house and saw what looked like some animals prowling around the backyard. Not coyotes, Natalie thought. People. One of them fell face first, tramping towards the woods in the drifting snow. Another gunshot sounded, and then there was a disturbing squeal of laughter. The snow was still coming down, but she could see that there were three people, two boys and a girl, and one of the boys was shooting at some bottles sitting on a wooden picnic table in the woods.
Sloane! Natalie yelled.
Her voice was nearly lost in the immensity of the stormy night.
Is that you? Natalie called out again. Sloane! Your mom's here looking for you. Are you okay?
It only took a second for Natalie to recognize them as Reed and his friend Greg Woodson. Sloane was flailing, trying to pull herself to her feet in an uncoordinated way. Something was wrong with her.
Here, Sloane, Natalie said as she approached, reaching out her hand. You want to come with me?
Reed stepped in front of Natalie and said,
she's fine.
Is that who I think it is? Greg asked in a sedated slur. The one and only Miss Bellman?
Yes, Natalie answered. That's me, the one and only.
She put her hands under Sloane's armpits and helped her to her feet. Your mom's inside the house.
She's going to be able to tell, Sloane said. She's smart.
Be able to tell what? Natalie asked.
That we took GHB, Sloane answered. And Coke. And what else was there? There was something else too, right?
Jesus, Greg said. Just be quiet, will you?
Sloane, come with me, Natalie was worried. I'll take you to the Jeep and we'll wait for your mom.
Greg took a menacing step towards Natalie, and she saw that he had a revolver in his hand.
When we're not at school, I don't think you get to tell us what to do. You're trespassing, aren't you?
Natalie glanced towards the house, hoping to see a burst of light from the front door.
Help, she thought, a tiny voice in her head.
Help me.
Sloane, she said. Let's go, okay?
Greg put his arm out to stop Sloane.
It doesn't look like she wants to go with you. Stop it, Greg, Reed said. Give me my mom's gun. What? Why? Just give it to me.
Greg handed it over, sulking. Reed slipped the revolver into the back of his pants, and Natalie took a deep, shuddering breath.
Sorry, Miss Bellman, Reed said. It's my mom's. It's legal and everything. We were just shooting some targets in the snow.
He plunged his hands into his big parka pockets.
Listen, Miss Bellman, I can get your phone back for you.
Natalie had already accepted the fact that she'd never see that phone again, but she was surprised. You can?
Yeah, I took it. I was hoping to get dirt on Coach Nick, so we could finally put that whole thing from last spring behind us.
Which wasn't even that big a deal, Greg said, looking cross-eyed and as if he was about to pass out.
Because of a few photos, Jeremiah lost his car. I lost my PS5 and almost went to military school. Everyone says Alice,
he was slurring and couldn't pronounce Alistair.
Everyone thinks Alistair is in Grand Cayman, but he's really in some rehab place in Switzerland, getting his brain hard drive erased and rebooted with some bullshit oxygen tank treatment that's going to leave him a retard. I bet Casper's never even coming back from Poland now. Greg, can you be quiet for a minute?
Reed seemed ashamed.
It was dumb. We never should have taken any photos. It wasn't worth it. Right, Sloane?
Sloane nodded and said,
No way. No way. Never again.
But once we did do it, Reed explained, Coach Nick held it over us like he was a mob boss or something. I saw the two of you leaving the school together a few times, and it seemed like you had something going on with him. I just thought, I don't know, that maybe there would be something on your phone that I could use against him, so I could get free of him. It was a bad idea, and I'm sorry. But I hated him, and I had to try.
Natalie couldn't believe it. Reed Leland wasn't quite the monster that she'd thought. She was at a loss for words.
I'll bring your phone back to you on Wednesday at school, Reed said. And by the way, you should change your passcode. 1234 is no good.
Thanks.
A laugh escaped, and she said, But I don't even know if I'll be at school on Wednesday.
Why not? Reed asked.
Just then, a side door of the house opened, and light spilled out. Brooke yelled,
Sloane, are you out there?
Here, Mom,
Sloane answered, and Brooke came running, as best she could, through a lawn covered in 4 inches of snow. Reed plodded drunkenly behind Sloane all the way to the Jeep, while Greg lumbered back to the house. Linda's silhouette could be seen, watching in the front window. When they were loaded up in the Jeep, Reed blew a kiss through the window. Sloane caught it, touched her fingers to her lips, and smiled.
Where am I going? Natalie asked. Am I driving straight north and over the border to Canada? Why would you do that?
Sloane asked groggily from the back seat, and Brooke flashed Natalie a warning look.
Not in front of her.
We need to talk with Asha, Brooke said, looking at her phone. I've texted her a million times, and she hasn't texted back.
She was admitted to the hospital this morning, Natalie said.
What? Is she all right?
I don't know. I would have checked on her, but I was being held hostage in Mr. Dilly's conference room all day.
Go there, then. We'll make sure she's all right. Get all our stories straight.
What stories?
Sloane mumbled from the back seat.
Nothing, Brooke said, reaching back to put one hand on Sloane's knee. You just go to sleep.
39. Asha had been having a beautiful dream. It was years earlier when Mia was a slightly chubby, bow-legged toddler who loved bath time and all her water toys. Asha used to line them up on the edge of the gigantic jacuzzi tub. There were rolls of baby fat on Mia's arms and legs and belly, and her brown hair was still thin, soft, and short. Her smile was magnetic even then, and her eyes so luminous and cheerful that just looking in them brought joy. On her pudgy baby finger was a dragonfly ring, even though Asha hadn't given her that ring until she was 12. Nick was suddenly there too, in the bathroom with Asha, watching Mia bathe, and he said,
"Look at that cute little silver dragonfly ring."
Then he raised his phone to take a picture, and Asha hid it out of his hand, yelling, "No!" That was what woke her, and she must have spoken out loud, because it woke Phil as well. He'd been sleeping upright, slumped against the wall in the corner of the hospital room, and his whole body jerked. Nearly falling out of his chair toward the hospital bed, he asked,
"Are you okay?"
"I don't know," she answered truthfully, looking around in an anxious fright. "I don't know." The memory of what happened in the gym was starting to form again, following hours of sedatives and sleep. In the back of her mind was the image of Mr. McGuire going over the balcony in slow motion, her hands and Brooks against his chest. Phil didn't appear to know what had happened. "What's going on?" she asked. She needed answers. Who knows what?
"I slept in the basement last night because you were snoring. One of the ladies from the carpool was just picking the kids up for school when I woke, and Mia told me you hadn't gotten out of bed yet. I found you in the bathroom. You were thrashing around. You said, 'Something's wrong with the baby,' and I brought you here."
"And is something wrong with the baby?" Asha asked, hands flying to her stomach.
"Dr. Ruiz said there's a tear in your amniotic sac. You need to stay on bed rest and let them monitor the situation. You'll either be induced eventually or be here in the hospital until the delivery. But the baby's going to be fine either way. Early, but fine."
Asha reached out and grabbed his arm.
"Are you sure?"
Phil nodded and leaned down to kiss her cheek.
"You're not lying?" Asha asked.
"No, honey, no. I wouldn't lie about something like that."
Asha didn't let go. She pulled him closer.
"What would you lie about?"
"I'm not sure what you mean."
"You said you wouldn't lie to me about something like that, but you were happy to lie to me about something else, weren't you?"
Phil pulled his hand out of hers, wiped one of his eyes, and dragged the chair over to her bedside.
"How did you find out?"
he asked, sitting and looking down at the floor in a wretched way. Asha hadn't expected an immediate confession.
"I found out that you were at Le Méridien last spring. I know you were with someone. You had dinner in your room, 2 meals and 2 bottles of wine."
Phil nodded.
"How could you?" she asked. "I've been a good wife. I've been a good friend. I've been fun and loving, and I've been a good mom to our kids. I thought our sex life was great and—
Wait, he said. Wait, wait, wait.
And with my friend. How could you? With her."
"Who? What are you talking about?"
"Brooke, I know about the lies."
"Stop. There's only one lie, and I'm not cheating on you, and certainly not with Brooke. When you said, 'I know,' I thought you meant you knew about the lawsuit. Are you serious? Do you actually think I'm interested in anybody besides you?"
"I thought you were interested in anybody besides me. Look at me. I'm a mess. What lawsuit? Are you saying you weren't cheating on me?"
"No, baby, I didn't cheat on you. I love you. I would never do that. But I did lie to you. 6 months ago, one of my clients lost a lot of money and sued me for mismanagement. I didn't want to tell you because I knew it would upset you, and I thought I could work it out. The whole thing stressed me out to the point where I was sick, stomach aches, insomnia, and then fatigue, and then vice versa. The whole time, I just kept thinking about how your parents never thought I was good enough for you, and what they were going to say when I lost my license, and you would have to rescue me with your family money. It was horrible. I had to go to Denver on a number of occasions for meetings, some early, some late, a few requiring an overnight. I did see Brooke there once. I ran into her at that seafood place on Larimer Square, and we had oysters and drinks, but not sex. I did ask her not to mention it to you, and she said she totally understood about keeping business issues separate from family, and, you know, she was nice about it, to be honest. Later, I had dinner with Bob Bruckheimer, at my hotel. We both had steak and we split a couple of bottles of Merlot. We've had a few meetings like that over the last 6 months.
Asha closed her eyes and rested her head against the pillow.
I hate you, she said.
But do you still love me?
He asked, smiling.
Yes. I'm just so happy. I'm so happy that you got sued instead of falling in love with someone else.
Phil laughed.
And the best part is, I wasn't in Phoenix the other night. That was another lie. I'm sorry. I was in Denver at the Le Meridien eating steak and drinking wine without you. With Bob. Again. Good news, too. The lawsuit has been dropped.
Natalie parked the Jeep outside of the Colorado Medical. She, Brooke, and Sloane, who was still weaving a little when she walked, entered through the revolving double doors that led into the lobby. Due to the storm, it was a quiet evening. The gift shop was closing for the night. A few nurses and doctors walked the halls, but there were barely any visitors. The ones there looked like they'd scoped out a couch or a chair, collapsed, and planned to stay out the storm. On the second floor, outside the maternity ward, was a sitting area with several couches, a big screen television, and a table piled high with children's books. Oliver was there with Mia. He was playing on his iPad, and she was scrolling on her phone.
Hi, kids, Brooke said, trying to sound cheerful.
How's your mom?
Oliver looked up first.
Hi, Mrs. Elliman. Dad says she's going to be okay.
Sloane slumped down next to Mia.
I'm sorry to hear that she's sick, she said. What happened to her?
Something with the baby, Mia answered. It was scary.
Are you okay? Sloane asked.
Yeah, I am now. Are you?
Sloane grunted.
Yeah.
But just barely? Mia asked, laughing, some sort of inside joke. Sloane yawned.
Yeah, just barely.
She put her head down on Mia's shoulder. Mia readjusted a little bit to make it more comfortable for Sloane, and then went back to scrolling through her phone. Phil walked in from the direction of the rooms, looking bedraggled.
Brooke, he said, surprised to see her. It's so nice of you to come. Jesus, and with the apocalypse storm bearing down too. You're a good friend.
I try. Is she up for visitors? Brooke asked.
That would be great, actually, he said. If you could keep her company for a little bit, I need to get these kids home and feed them before we're stuck here.
He didn't seem to notice Natalie, who was trying her best to be invisible by examining a terribly boring painting in shades of brown over one of the couches. Outside, the gusting wind rattled the windows. The hospital was surrounded by large trees, and there was a startling noise above as a branch, whipped asunder, came crashing down on the roof. The lights suddenly flickered. Dark, light, dark. A flurry of voices could be heard barking questions and answers down the hall. After a few seconds, the power was completely on again.
You should go now, Brooke said, and drive safe. I keep getting notifications about pileups on the interstate. Try and stay off Devil's Canyon.
Can Sloane come with us?
Mia asked, throwing an arm around her shoulder and making a pretty pleased pout. Brooke looked at Phil.
I don't know. That would be up to your dad, and he's already had a hard day, so.
We'd love to have Sloane, Phil said. That would cheer me up, I think. Can they do a sleepover? I'm going to have a whiskey when I get home, and I don't want to drive again tonight.
That would be great, Phil, Brooke said. Thank you. I'll come get her in the morning.
Asha's bed was next to a small, padded bench at the base of a window. A television was mounted high on the wall. Underneath, it was a round table and two chairs. The overhead light was off, but there was a nightlight just below the shelf on the far wall. Asha had fallen back asleep after the conversation with Phil. By her bedside was a monitor quietly reporting her vitals. In her hand was the television remote, but the volume was on mute. The only noise was the whisper of air coming and going from Asha's slightly parted lips.
Hey, Brooke said softly, leaning down.
Asha? After a second, Brooke cleared her throat and said more loudly.
Okay,
Time to wake up. Asha's eyes flew open, and she looked startled and a little pissed.
You scared me, Brooke.
I'm sorry. We need to talk to you.
Natalie, Asha said, what are you doing here?
She knows everything, Brooke answered. It's a long story.
Asha struggled to sit up and reached out for Natalie.
Come here.
Natalie approached and took her hand gently.
What do you know? Asha asked.
Natalie sniffed, trying not to be too emotional.
I know I was in a relationship with a sick man who was keeping secrets from me. I know that he was doing the private training sessions with your daughters, and that he did bad things, like giving them something to make them sleep and taking photos of them. I know he hurt them, and I hate him, and that whatever happened to him, he absolutely deserved, and I'm just so sorry.
The sound of three quick knocks made Natalie snap her mouth shut and look fearfully towards the door.
Just checking in on my favorite mother-to-be and real estate magician. How are you feeling?
The doctor standing in the doorway of the room was Elena Ruiz. She had high cheekbones and dark hair pulled back in a bun. She was even more beautiful than Natalie remembered from that day months before, when she'd seen her embracing Nick at the gas station in town. No one had told Natalie about Nick's intervention with Mia, and she still believed that Nick had gone to the Ruiz house for a clandestine tryst with Elena the night before. Natalie felt physically sick. She wanted, in the worst way, to get out of that room.
I'm good, thank you, Elena, Asha answered, trying her best to sound composed. How nice to see you. I wasn't expecting you.
I just got here. Barely, I might add. The roads are terrible. You all should think about getting home safe and sound. But I had a look at your chart and spoke to Dr. Gordon. You and the baby are doing really well, considering. We're going to try to keep the situation very calm and under control here for a little bit longer while I do some tests. There's a slight chance we may want to look at giving you some steroids to make sure the baby's lungs are in good shape in case of an early arrival, but I won't make that decision until tomorrow. I'm not worried about you or the baby. Everything is going to be fine.
Everything is going to be fine? Asha repeated, looking at Natalie and Brooke. Did you two hear that?
Asha let out a short, sharp laugh.
Everything is going to be fine. I sure hope you're right.
Get some rest, okay? Elena said. I'm here all night if you need anything.
The doctor tucked her clipboard under her arm and left. Natalie watched her go. Elena was clearly a wealthy, educated, graceful woman. An older woman who didn't look like she would play Nick's ridiculous games or be his type. But the fact of Nick's tie crumpled on the floor of a bedroom in her house indicated otherwise. Suddenly, overwhelmed by it all, Natalie said,
I need some fresh air. Brooke, you tell Asha the news about Nick. Figure out what the two of you want to do, and I'll be back in 20 minutes to drive you home.
She wanted to see him. Natalie took the stairs down to the intensive care unit. It smelled of disinfectant and coffee. The lights were too bright, and the sterile white atmosphere was depressing. The nurses looked tired and overworked, shuffling from room to room, pushing carts and computers. There was a man in a uniform leaning over the central desk. Natalie didn't think he was a police officer. Whatever task he'd been given, he'd abandoned it to chat with a slender blonde nurse in hot pink scrubs. Natalie surveyed the hallway. Only one room had a fold-up chair placed against the wall beside the door. The chair would have been set up there for the guard. Nick's room. The security guard was badgering the pretty blonde nurse about getting a drink sometime. Natalie passed behind them and continued on down the hall. Nick's room was mostly dark, except for a strip of light spilling through the cracked bathroom door and the flickering red lights from a myriad of machines. The door was ajar, and Natalie slipped through without changing its position. Nick was reclining on the raised back of the white bed, heavily bandaged. Most of his body was underneath a blanket, but his arms, one in a cast and one not, rested on top. Natalie took a few tentative steps inside.
Nick, she said softly, and the sound of her own voice chilled her because it was eerily similar to when she said his name in the gym as he lay there bleeding from his head wound. Are you awake?
Nothing.
Can you hear me?
Nothing. She approached the bed and leaned down. He smelled like an old man, bad breath, body odor, and antiseptic.
I know what you did, she said close to his ear. I know what you did to Sloane and Mia.
Suddenly, the lights in the hallway went dark for the second time. Another power outage. The machines in his room continued to blip on and off. Red, white. A dinging sound, but otherwise completely quiet. Again, they were alone. She leaned down close to his face, to see him better in the pitch-black hospital room. His eyes sprang open. A terrified scream froze in her throat. He made a noise. She waited, listening to his breath coming and going. It appeared he wanted to say something.
Listen, Natalie said, her eyes boring into his one good one. Can you hear me?
He moved a finger and then blinked.
Good, she said. That's good.
Was he trying to smile? It seemed like he was happy to see her. Natalie smiled back and said,
When the police come to see you in the morning, you say you fell, okay? That's what happened. Or it's all going to come out. If you talk, we'll all talk.
Secretly, Natalie believed he would likely deny everything, but it was worth a try.
Do we have a deal? You fell. Are we clear?
Maybe.
His lips were parched and swollen. His hand rolled over, palm up. He wanted her to take it. A momentary surge of pity caused her to oblige. With her hand in his, he squeezed and said,
Don't.
Don't what? She asked. Don't believe it? How can I not believe it? I saw.
No. Don't.
Don't what?
Don't be a bitch.
Her mouth dropped open from shock before a wave of hot fury swept through her body. For a second, she pictured herself smothering him with a pillow. She began reaching for the one behind his head. Like an explosion, the overheads in the hall burst back on, flooding the room with white light. There was a noise, and Natalie spun toward the door. A doctor in full scrubs, mask, and a cap was standing behind her. Only the eyes were visible, but the doctor's body language seemed to suggest that he or she was shocked to find Natalie there.
I made a wrong turn, Natalie mumbled, choking back tears of anger, frustration, and fear. I'm sorry.
She ran down the hall to get away from him once and for all. The mood in the Jeep was somber as Natalie drove Brooke back to her house. The windshield wipers were going back and forth like crazy, trying to keep a half circle of glass clear. The snow seemed to be coming from all directions. Natalie came up behind a slow-moving plow and settled in to follow his taillights, like a lighthouse in the fog, for a long climb back up the mountain.
What did you and Asha decide? Natalie asked. What's the story?
We showed up to get Sloane. Nick was acting strangely, drunk or on drugs. We left abruptly. That's it.
And what will you say when he says you pushed him over the balcony?
Remember, Brooke answered, that he nearly died from a traumatic brain injury. He could wake up and start talking about spaceships, unicorns, and flying monkeys.
He's going to say that you pushed him, and he's going to say that I broke his phone and left him there to die.
Natalie parked the Jeep outside Brooke's house.
He's going to say horrible things about us and your daughters. Imagine the information he has to work with. It's going to be a nightmare. It will be our word against his.
We'll fight, Brooke said. He's a pedophile and a pornographer. We'll expose him for what he is and what he's done.
But the police won't see it that way, Natalie responded. They'll say you don't get to push someone over a balcony just because you think he did something wrong. You and Asha will go to jail, and probably me too.
Brooke opened the passenger door and stepped out.
I don't think it will come to that.
Are you sure you don't want to make a run for the border?
Looking completely worn out, Brooke sighed.
Natalie, do you even have a passport?
No.
I didn't think so. Go home and get some sleep. Tomorrow, be ready to tell the police that you walked into the gym and thought that he was dead. You panicked and left. That will cover you no matter what he says. Asha and I have our own story. That's all, okay?
Brooke sounded ominously resigned, suspiciously resigned.
We'll all do what we have to do.
Okay. Good night.
Goodbye, Natalie.
It felt very final. When she got home, Natalie flopped down onto the bed. Her head hit something hard.
She reached underneath the comforter and pulled out her landline receiver, which she had taken to sleep with her the previous night and totally forgotten about since. It was blinking. She picked it up and typed in her password, which was also 1234.
I've got to change that, she said to herself.
The machine voice said,
You have one message.
It was from the day before. The call had come in early Sunday morning after the fall feast. She remembered now that she'd taken her landline to bed with her and waited for Nick to check on her, like he'd said he would. After several hours, she'd taken some pain pills and finally fallen into a deep sleep. She pressed the button to listen to his message. Natalie had seen him drunk on very few occasions, but while leaving this message, he was clearly not in his right mind. He was whispering in a threatening way, and she was certain he was under the influence of alcohol, drugs, or both.
You crossed the line tonight, taking my phone? You are a crazy bitch and I'm done with you. Don't talk to me at school. Don't call or text. Pretend you don't know me and pretend you never knew me. I don't require your services anymore.
He hung up. I don't require your services anymore, she echoed, staring at the receiver in her hand. A part of her wanted to throw the phone, pound a beer, smash a vase, call Jay and cry. Another part of her was just disgusted and tired. What a stupid, tragic, fucked up ending to a stupid, tragic, fucked up fling.
40.
The storm had ended sometime in the middle of the night, leaving the valley with a dazzling and blinding backdrop of radiant white snow. The tree branches dripped with sharp, icy daggers, and there was that strange quiet that accompanied the aftermath of a large snowfall, as if all of nature was trying to sleep in, cuddled up in a soft blanket. When she opened her eyes, Natalie had a clear and sudden understanding of what she needed to do. She stood in her bathroom, putting drops in her eyes and practicing, I thought he was dead. I was going to call for help. His phone wasn't working. I was upset and felt sick, and I didn't want to be there. I panicked and left. She repeated her statement several times in a variety of different voices, and then rehearsed her responses to their possible questions. It was already broken, she practiced answering. That's not right. I think he must be confused. Understandable, given his injuries. Asha and Brooke could tell whatever story they wanted to tell. That was up to them. Natalie had no intention of contradicting them. She had no reason to. Natalie walked over to the kitchen counter. She found Ken's business card in her purse and sat down on her couch. After a few nervous minutes, she forced herself to pick up her home phone.
Detective Ken Bradley here.
Natalie said. Good morning, Detective Bradley. This is Natalie Bellman.
You better not be canceling, he said.
She could hear him taking a sip of something, probably his morning coffee. No, but I was wondering if I could talk to you now.
Oh, okay, sure.
Could I see you? Talk in person? Would that be possible?
Hold on.
Ken muted her, and she waited until he returned.
Listen, Natalie, he said.
Yes?
I'm with Detective Larson right now. She and I are just about to pull into the parking lot of the hospital. If you drive down here to meet us, we can chat straight away.
I'm almost ready to walk out the door, she said. I can be there in 30 minutes.
All right. Give me a call when you get here.
The streets had been plowed, and aside from the dirty banks of sludge pushed to the side of every road, it was a clean new day. The fir trees twinkled like giant green gowned ladies in sequined dresses, and there was a crisp, bright, radiant aura hovering above the glowing horizon. Natalie walked through the doors to the hospital and made a left turn toward the intensive care unit. The gift shop was open, a kiosk of cards, stuffed animals, and balloon bouquets out in front. Just past the lobby, by the first of several desks and a handful of nurses, she stopped and used the wall phone to make her call to Ken. I'm here, she said, leaning against the counter. Sure, I'll wait. I'm not going anywhere. A middle-aged man with weary, bent posture and thick glasses looked over and asked, Can I help you, miss? I'm fine, thank you, she answered. I'm just waiting to speak to the detectives who are back with Nicholas McGuire.
Oh, too bad about that, he said, his watery, kind eyes magnified behind his lenses.
Wait, what?
What do you mean?
He started pawing through some papers. You didn't hear? Are you family or?
Family, she said. I lost my phone. What's too bad?
Natalie looked down the hallway and saw Ken and Beth emerge from around a corner. They were heading her way.
At times like this, I think it's important to mention that we have a chapel right here in the hospital.
What? She demanded. What happened?
He succumbed to his injuries, the man said apologetically. Last night. But if it helps, I can assure you he didn't suffer. In fact, he never regained consciousness. He passed peacefully in his sleep.
Oh my God.
Maybe you should sit down.
She forced herself to pull it together. She turned around as the detectives were just approaching.
Natalie, Ken said pleasantly. Good morning.
Natalie opened her mouth, but nothing came out. Ken scowled and crossed his arms impatiently.
You wanted to talk?
He prompted.
This young lady has just received some bad news,
the nurse interjected kindly while cleaning his glasses with a tissue.
I don't think now is the—
This young lady, Ken interrupted, has just gone from being a person of interest in a suspicious incident to a person of interest in a murder.
Yes, sir.
And with that, the friendly nurse stood up, looked for something to do, and began sanitizing his hands. Ken was staring Natalie down in a menacing way.
Nick isn't going to wake up. He isn't going to talk. Maybe Asha and Brooke will be fine. Maybe no one will ever know that I left him to die.
Why did you want to see us this morning?
Ken demanded.
I wanted to let you know, she stalled.
What?
I know who has my phone. It's a student who is involved peripherally, but also somewhat importantly, like part of the investigation somewhat. He found it on the floor and he's going to give it back to me tomorrow, so if you still want it, I can give it to you then. I know you wanted to see it, and so, Beth said, not in an unfriendly manner.
You're kind of rambling, but you're saying you found your phone?
Yes.
That's great, but really?
Ken asked.
That's it?
No, Natalie said, in a way that seemed terribly consequential. That's not it.
She looked down and took a deep breath.
What?
Ken asked.
There's more, she answered.
Beth gave her a quizzical look. Natalie, please, we're busy. What else?
Nick's dog. Somebody has to go get Nick's dog. He's in the townhome.
Somebody picked him up this morning, Beth said. Relax, okay? The dog is fine. Ken, we're supposed to be meeting with Harry Doyle right now.
Right,
Ken pointed at Natalie.
2 o'clock at the police station.
I'll be there.
Ken and Beth walked off towards the escalator, and Natalie pretended to be headed for the hospital exit. Once they were gone, she booked it back to the elevator and went up to the second floor. She ran down the hallway to Asha's room, praying she would still be there. She was.
Natalie, Asha exclaimed. You look like you stuck your finger in a light socket.
Asha was beside herself, and Natalie pulled the door shut behind her before going over to her bedside.
He died, Natalie tried to whisper. Last night.
Asha slapped her hand down on the adjustable table at her bedside.
Mr. McGuire?
Yes, Nick, Natalie said, shifting from side to side like she needed to pee.
I can't believe it.
Asha put her hands together in prayer, looked up, and said a few whispered words.
Can you call Brooke? Natalie asked, and let her know before they interview her?
I'll do it right now. What time is it? Oh, shit, I'm supposed to be meeting with the detectives in 30 minutes.
Okay, I'm going to get out of here before they see me, Natalie said, backing out of the room. You've got this?
We've got this. Go, go. Brooke and I will work it out. Thank you.
When Natalie arrived at the Falcon Valley Police Station, she approached the officer at the entrance desk, a grim, middle-aged woman in a bad mood.
I'm here to see Detectives Bradley and Larson.
The officer escorted Natalie down the hall and said, Second door on the right. Natalie found herself in a featureless lobby, consisting of 2 plaid couches on either side of a long, low coffee table, scattered with various brochures. Waiting for a long time, she was able to read up on a variety of topics from bicycle theft to domestic violence. She tore out the number for a local law firm. About ready to ask the man sitting at the big desk at the far end of the room if she would have to wait much longer, she heard footsteps coming towards the lobby from the back of the station, loud clapping footsteps like a woman marching in heels. Natalie craned her neck to peer down the hall, and she could see Brooke walking side by side between Beth and Ken. Sloane was trailing behind them, her hair hanging around her shoulders like a Manson girl doing her perp walk. Brooke was wearing a high-waisted pencil skirt and a tight turtleneck. She looked both breathtaking and intimidating. Brooke spotted Natalie, and her expression revealed nothing whatsoever. She passed with not so much as a slight nod. If anything, she held her chiseled chin up higher to avoid any eye contact. Natalie was immediately anxious and uneasy, which quickly turned into a chill up her neck and a twisting fist in her gut. She hunched over. This was not good. This was not good at all. For the first time, it dawned on her that Nick's death might be the worst thing that could have happened to her. Had he woken up, the nastiest thing he could have accused her of was breaking his phone and walking away. Dead, his words had disappeared with him. Without his story, there was only the evidence. Her fingerprints and the sticky blood on Nick's phone. Walking in and out of the gym twice. The horrible things she'd written in the planner. Then, with a shudder, Natalie considered what else there was to still find. Whatever blood was left on her skirt, wadded up in a Target bag under her sink. A message she'd left for her brother saying, "I did something bad." Natalie had the urge to run, the fight or flight instinct kicking in, telling her that if the police thought it was murder, she was the obvious killer. Not the rich, powerful moms, but the damaged girl, the outsider, the thief, drug addict, and obsessive ex-girlfriend. She stood up and was about to leave when, at that moment, Ken appeared in front of her, blocking her path. He held out his phone, and on the screen was a photo of Nick wearing a huge, toothsome, thank God it's Friday sort of smile. He was standing between Lars Jaeger and Carmen Sorella. They were hugging one another, with the Fall Feast stage as a backdrop, and he was wearing his turquoise blue soccer ball print Vineyard Vines necktie, the one that the detectives found wadded up in the back of Natalie's work desk.
"Natalie, I'm not even going to mention the lost earbuds bullshit lie right now," Ken said. "I'm just going to show you this photo. When I asked around for recent pics of the victim, this is one that was sent to me. Looks like this one was taken the night of the Fall Feast, the night before his accident."
He stood there, phone held out, photo in her face.
"Recognize the tie? Are you sure you stole that tie out of the lost and found?"
Ken sounded like he was talking to a bad dog.
"Care to change your story?"
Natalie glanced over her shoulder at the window. Quaint, ranch-style, sprawling town, foothills, the mountains behind them, the canyons beyond that, and the plains, the borders, the other countries, all the rest of the world she'd so wanted to see. So many places she could have run if she'd had the guts.
"Did you lie?"
Ken asked. "Obviously," she said, finally giving in to the nervous laughter, the exhaustion, and the absurdity of the whole ridiculous situation. "I mean, obviously I did."
"Natalie Bellman,"
he said,
"you're under arrest for the murder of Nicholas McGuire.